the history of the People's Republic, grain was being imported from the imperialist camp. Then Zhu, in a rather roundabout manner, inquired about the Soviet Union's willingness to trade 2 million tons of grain against soybeans, bristles and tin, possibly even rice. Only a third would be paid up front. The rest would follow over the next 2 years. Coming just after the delegation had balked at a trade deficit of 70 million rubles, the timing of the request was poor. "Do you have any foreign currency?" the Soviet side asked bluntly, forcing Zhu to admit that China had none, and that it was selling silver. The delegation left the issue hanging in the air, and nothing further happened for several months, till finally someone dropped a hint by telling Deng Xiaoping that the Soviet Union was experiencing difficulties and was not in a position to help. The loss of face for China must have been tremendous. Delaying tactics in the midst of calamity were also adopted by Moscow when Zhu Enlai asked for an extra 20,000 tons of petrol in July 1961. Khrushchev waited for 4 months until after the 22nd Soviet Party Congress before acceding to Beijing's request. Political leverage was also extracted from a swap of grain agreed upon in June 1961. Out of all the wheat Beijing purchased from Canada, 280,000 tons were earmarked for the Soviet Union, which in turn exported a similar amount to China. After the wheat had been shipped directly to Russia from Canada, the Soviets acted as if the import came from North America, at the same time listing their export of grain to China in the published trade statistics for the year 1961. In the eyes of the world, with foreign experts raking over published statistics for signs of a rift between the two socialist giants, it looked as if the Soviet Union was feeding China. Not all of the grain purchased abroad was intended for home consumption. The rice bought from Burma, for instance, was shipped directly to Ceylon to meet outstanding commitments. Some 160,000 tons also found their way to East Germany to address the trade deficit with socialist allies. And China, in the midst of famine, continued to be generous to its friends. 2 cargoes of wheat carrying some 60,000 tons were shipped directly to Tirana from Canadian ports as a gift. Since Albania had a population of about 1.4 million, this amount provided as much as 1/5 of domestic requirements. Pupo Shaiti, Tirana's chief negotiator in Beijing, later recalled that he could see the signs of famine in Beijing, but the Chinese gave us everything. When we needed anything, we just asked the Chinese. I felt ashamed. Other countries, aside from Albania, also received rice for free at the height of the famine. For instance, Guinea, the recipient of 10,000 tons in 1961. China never ceased to cultivate its international image with liberal aid and cheap loans to developing nations in Asia and Africa. One reason why Beijing increased foreign donations during the Great Leap Forward was to prove that it had discovered the bridge to a communist future. But the main consideration was rivalry with Moscow. In an age of decolonization, Khrushchev had started competing for the allegiance of developing nations, trying to draw them away from the United States into the Soviet orbit by lavishing aid on prestige projects such as dams and stadiums. Mao wanted to challenge him for leadership in Asia and Africa. Dismissive of the Kremlin's notion of peaceful evolution, on which relations with the developing world were premised, he encouraged instead a militant theory of revolution, aiding communist revolutionaries in such countries as Algeria, Cameroon, Kenya, and Uganda in determined competition with Moscow. How much help was given in times of famine? Overall, China provided 4 billion yuan to foreign countries from 1950 to July 1960, of which 2.8 billion was free economic aid, and 1.2 billion came as interest-free or low-interest loans. Most of this was granted from 1958 onwards. In 1960, as a new body called the Foreign Economic Liaison Bureau with ministerial rank was created to cope with increased donations, aid to foreign countries was fixed at 420 million yuan. The following year, as Beijing refused new loans or even deferment of payments offered by socialist allies aware of China's predicament, some 660 million yuan was slated for foreign aid. The beneficiaries included Burma at $84 million and Cambodia at 11.2 million, while Vietnam was granted 142 million rubles and Albania 112.5 million rubles. These sums were made available as the overall income of the state shrank by 45% to 35 billion yuan, cuts having been made in a number of areas, including 1.4 billion in health and education. Such generosity meant that on the ground, where people were starving, grain was still being exported in 1960, some of it for free. In fact, with a policy of export above all else, Chukuo Di, just about every province had to export more than ever before. Hunan was instructed to export goods to the value of 423 million yuan, or 3.4% of the total output value of the province. The produce to be exported, including 300,000 tons of rice and 270,000 pigs. In the 5 months following Zhou Enlai's decision in August 1960 to curb the export of food to the socialist camp, well over 100,000 tons of grain were procured in Guangdong and sent to Cuba, Indonesia, Poland, and Vietnam, representing about a quarter of the 470,000 tons requisitioned in the province during that period. As provincial boss Tao Zhu explained after formal diplomatic relations were established with Fidel Castro's regime in September 1960, delivering grain to the people of Cuba, besieged by American imperialism, was a matter of international reputation. Factory workers in Guangzhou were less enthusiastic about selfless assistance to the developing world, already bitter about the lack of cotton, exported and put on sale in the department stores of Hong Kong. They openly wondered, why export to Cuba when we don't have enough to eat? Even in places as far away as Gansu, villagers protested that they had to go hungry because Mao was shipping rice to Cuba. At a party gathering in Bei Daihe the following month, the leadership decided to send Castro a further 100,000 tons of rice worth 26 million yuan in exchange for sugar. Could China have accepted aid instead of spending all its foreign currency on grain imports? President John Kennedy apparently noted coolly that Beijing was still exporting food to Africa and Cuba even in a time of famine, adding that, "We've had no indication from the Chinese communists that they would welcome any offer of food." The Red Cross did try to assist, but approached Beijing in a blundering way by first inquiring about famine in Tibet, where a major rebellion had just been squashed by the People's Liberation Army. The response was swift and predictable. The country had witnessed an unprecedentedly rich harvest in 1960. There was absolutely no famine, and rumours to the contrary were slanderous. Adding fuel to the fire, Henrik Beer, clumsy Secretary-General of the League of Red Cross Societies, then sent a second telegram from Geneva asking whether this was true as well for China. A furious reply followed from Beijing, pointing out that Tibet and China were not separate entities, but constituted one country, throughout which the government relied on the many advantages of the people's communes to overcome the natural calamities of the previous 2 years. But even had the Red Cross broached the issue in a more tactful way, it is very likely that foreign help would have been refused. When the Japanese foreign minister had a quiet word with his counterpart, Chen Yi, about a discreet gift of 100,000 tons of wheat to be shipped out of the public view, he was rebuffed. Even gifts of clothes by schoolchildren in East Berlin, offered to help typhoon-ravaged Guangdong in 1959, were seen as a loss of face, and embassies were told to accept no further donations. China was willing to patronize the developing world, but would accept help from nobody. Chapter 16. Finding a Way Out. Faced with a bankrupt economy, Zhou Enlai, Li Fuchun, and Li Xianyan, the triumvirate in charge of foreign trade, began in August 1960 to move the trade structure away from the Soviet Union towards the West. In the following months, Zhou Enlai and Chen Yun managed to convince Mao that imports of grain were needed to get the economy back on its feet after the agricultural losses attributed to natural disasters. The party planners also started quietly masterminding a turnaround by tinkering, ever so prudently, with policy guidelines. Li Fuchun initiated work on a new motto that emphasized adjustment instead of great leaps forward in August 1960. In a one-party state where government by slogan held sway, the very notion of adjustment would have been unthinkable only 6 months earlier. Zhou Enlai warily added the term consolidation to make it more palatable to Mao. Li Fuchun would have to navigate carefully to get the new mantra passed a mercurial chairman. Then, on the 21st of October 1960, a report from the Ministry of Supervision landed on Li Fuchun's desk. It was about mass starvation in Xinjiang, a region in Wu Jipu's model province of Henan. Where an earlier investigation had mentioned 18,000 deaths in the county of Junyang alone, now the figure had quadrupled to 80,000 deaths. In Suiping, the seat of the hallowed Chiashan commune, 1 in 10 villagers had starved to death. When Li Fuchun handed over the report to Mao Zedong 3 days later, the chairman was visibly shaken. Here were counter-revolutionaries who had seized control of an entire region, carrying out horrific acts of revenge against class enemies. After an urgent meeting with Liu Shaoqi and Zhou Enlai, a team was dispatched under the leadership of Li Xianyan, who was joined en route by Dao Zhu and Wang Renzhong. In Xinjiang, they found a nightmare. In Guangshan County, ground zero of the famine, they were met by quiet sobs of despair from famished survivors, huddled in the bitter cold among the rubble of their destroyed homes, surrounded by barren fields marked by graves. The hearths were stone cold, as everything from doors, windows, and lintels to the straw roofs had been ripped out for fuel. The food was gone. In a reign of terror after the Lushan Plenum, the local militias had rampaged through the villages searching for hidden grain, confiscating everything to make up for the shortfall in output. In a hamlet once humming with activity, 2 children with drumstick limbs and skeletal heads, lying by their cadaverous grandmother, were the only survivors. 1 in 4 people in a local population of 500,000 had perished in Guangshan. Mass graves were dug. 10 infants, still breathing, had been thrown into the frozen ground in Chengguan. In total in 1960, over 1 million people died in the Xinjiang region. Of these victims, 67,000 were clubbed to death with sticks. Li Xianyan cried, "The defeat of the Western Route Army was so cruel, yet I did not shed a tear. But after seeing such horror in Guangshan, even I am unable to control myself. Bad people have seized power, causing beatings, deaths, grain shortages and hunger. The democratic revolution has not been completed as feudal forces full of hatred towards socialism are stirring up trouble, sabotaging socialist productive forces." Mao could no longer deny the extent of the disaster, but as a paranoid leader who saw the world in terms of plots and conspiracies, he blamed the trouble on class enemies. Rich farmers and counter-revolutionary elements had taken advantage of the anti-rightist campaign to worm their way back into power and carry out acts of class revenge. At no point did the chairman acknowledge that the regime of terror he modelled at the top was being mirrored at every level down the party hierarchy. Mao ordered power to be taken back. Across the country, a campaign unfolded to root out class enemies, often backed by powerful delegations sent by Beijing. Li Xianyan and Wan Renzhong supervised a purge in Henan in which county leaders were overthrown and thousands of cadres investigated, some arrested on the spot. A general with a 40-man team was dispatched by Beijing to clean up the militia. In Gansu, a delegation sent by the Ministry of Inspection, led by Jiang Ying, oversaw a major purge, which resulted in the downgrading of Zhang Zhongliang to third secretary of the Provincial Party Committee. Other regions followed, as one urgent order after another pressed for an overthrow of abusive cadres in the People's Communes. On the 3rd of November 1960, an emergency directive was finally issued allowing villagers to keep private plots, engage in side occupations, rest for 8 hours a day, and restore local markets, among other measures designed to weaken the power of the communes over villages. It was the beginning of the end of mass starvation. Sensing a change in the wind, Li Fuchun pushed through his policy of economic adjustment for the year 1961. He had been the first planner to back Mao in the launch of the Great Leap Forward. Now he was the first one to backtrack, prudently steering a policy of economic revival past the chairman. At this stage, Liu Shaoqi was still looking from the sidelines. He shared the chairman's view that the countryside had become a breeding ground for counter-revolution. Like other leaders, he had preferred to ignore what happened on the ground after the confrontation at Lushan, and instead devoted much of his energy to stridently denouncing the revisionist path taken by the Soviet Union. He was not oblivious to the famine. Malnourishment was evident even inside the vermilion walls of Zhongnanyai, the compound which served as the headquarters of the party in Beijing. Meat, eggs, and cooking oil were scarce, and famine, oedema, and hepatitis were endemic. But it was politically safer to interpret the signs of starvation as a result of environmental disasters. On the 20th of January 1961, Liu Shaoqi harangued an audience from Gansu about the dangers of feudalism, which had led to the calamity witnessed in Xinjiang. "This is a revolution. The key is in mobilizing the masses. We should mobilize the masses and allow them to free themselves." Only days before, Mao had voiced his surprise at the extent of the bourgeois backlash in the countryside. "Who would have thought that the countryside harbored so many counter-revolutionaries? We did not expect that the counter-revolution would usurp power at the village level and carry out cruel acts of class revenge." Instead of relying on the reports from the grassroots, which, Mao claimed, had obviously misled the leadership, the chairman decided to dispatch several high-powered teams to investigate the countryside. Deng Xiaoping, Zhou Enlai, and Peng Jin were all sent off to visit communes around Beijing. Mao himself spent several weeks in Hunan. In the hope that farmers would speak to him without inhibition, Liu Shaoqi headed back to his home in Huaminglu, Hunan. It would be a revelatory experience, with far-reaching repercussions. Determined to avoid the large retinue of bodyguards and local officials that inevitably came with every visit from a top dignitary, Liu set off on the 2nd of April 1961 from Changsha, travelling in two jeeps in the company of his wife and a few close assistants, bowl and chopsticks tucked away in light luggage, ready for a Spartan regime in the countryside. Soon the convoy came across a sign announcing a giant pig farm. On closer inspection, it turned out that the farm consisted of no more than a dozen scrawny hogs foraging in the mud. Liu decided to spend the night in the fodder store, and his escorts combed the place in vain for some rice straw to soften the plank beds. Liu noted that even the dried human excrement piled up for fertilizer consisted of nothing but rough fiber, another telltale sign of widespread want. Nearby, a few children in rags were digging for wild herbs. Liu Shaoqi's fears were confirmed over the following weeks, however difficult it was to get wary farmers to tell the truth. In one village where he stopped on his way home, he found that the number of deaths had been covered up by local leaders, while an official report drew a picture of everyday life which had nothing to do with the destitution Liu saw on the ground. He clashed with the local boss, who tried to steer the team away from speaking with villagers. He tracked down a carder who had been dismissed as a rightist in 1959. Duan Shucheng spoke up, explaining how the brigade had earned a red flag during the Great Leap Forward. To protect their privileged status, Duan explained, local leaders had systematically persecuted anybody who dared to voice a dissenting view. In 1960, a meager crop of 360 tons of grain was talked up to 600 tons. After requisitions, villagers were left with a paltry 180 kilos, out of which seed and fodder had to be taken, leaving a handful of rice a day. In his home village, Tan Si Chong, friends and relatives were less reluctant to speak out. They denied that there had been a drought the year before, blaming carders instead for the food shortages. "Man-made disasters are the main reason, not natural calamities." In the canteen, cooking utensils, dirty bowls and chopsticks were tossed in a pile on the floor. A few asparagus leaves were the only vegetable available, to be prepared without cooking oil. Liu was shaken by what he saw. A few days later, he apologized to his fellow villagers in a mass meeting. "I haven't returned home for nearly 40 years. I really wanted to come home for a visit. Now I have seen how bitter your lives are. We have not done our jobs well, and we beg for your pardon." That very evening the canteen was dissolved on Liu's orders. A committed party man, Liu Shaoqi was genuinely shocked by the disastrous state in which he found his home village. He had dedicated his every waking moment to the party, only to find that it had brought widespread abuse, destitution, and starvation to the people he was meant to serve. What he also discovered was a complete lack of connection between people and party. He had been deliberately kept in the dark, or so he claimed. While the details of his trip to the countryside are well known, his clash with the local officials is not. Liu first deflected blame onto party boss Jiang Pinghua, who had taken charge of the province after Zhuo Xiaochu's fall from power. "My hometown is in such a mess, but nobody has sent me a report, not even a single letter or a complaint. In the past, people used to send me letters, then it all stopped. I don't think that they didn't want to write or refuse to write. I am afraid that they simply were not allowed to write, or they did write and their letters were inspected and confiscated." With the Provincial Bureau for Public Security, he was blunt, accusing the security apparatus of being completely rotten. How could the local police be allowed to check and retain personal letters? And how could they get away with investigating and beating people for trying to bring local malpractices to his attention? Later, Liu confronted Si Fuqi, the powerful Minister of Public Security and close ally of Mao, asking him why abuse was allowed to go on unchecked in his hometown. Gone was the patient party builder Liu. Here was a man shaken in his faith, who had promised to speak out on behalf of his fellow villagers. Back in Beijing, Liu continued to speak his mind. On the 31st of May 1961, at a gathering of leaders, he made an emotional speech in which he bluntly placed the blame for the famine on the shoulders of the party. "Other problems that have appeared over the past few years actually due to natural disasters or to shortcomings and errors we have made in our work. In Hunan, the peasants have a saying that 30% is due to natural calamities, 70% to man-made disasters." Liu dismissed the attempt to gloss over the scale of the calamity, by dogmatically insisting that the overall policy of the party was a great success, touching a raw nerve by debunking one of Mao's favourite aphorisms. Some comrades say that these problems are merely one finger out of 10. But right now, I am afraid that this is no longer a matter of 1 out of 10. We always say 9 fingers versus 1 finger. The proportion never changes. But this doesn't quite fit the actual reality. We should be realistic and talk about things as they are. About the party line, he did not mince his words. In carrying out the party line, in organizing the people's communes, in organizing work for the Great Leap Forward, there have been many weaknesses and errors, even very serious weaknesses and errors. And he was in no doubt as to where the responsibility lay. The centre is the principal culprit. We leaders are all responsible. Let's not blame one department or one person alone. Liu was parting company with Mao. He got away with his blistering critique because the horror, by now, was so evident everywhere that it could no longer be brushed aside. He would pay dearly for his challenge during the Cultural Revolution, but for the time being other leaders cautiously leaned towards the head of state, ever so slightly inflecting the balance of power away from Mao. Zhou Enlai, always circumspect, acknowledged some of the errors made in the wake of the Lushan plenum, and then, to help the chairman save face, openly accepted blame for everything that had gone wrong. Liu Shaoqi took a chance by pushing the limits for critical debate, but Li Fuchun was the one who used the shift to engineer a strategic retreat away from the Great Leap Forward. A bookish man with self-effacing airs, he had been wary of putting forward dissenting views, but he too changed his tone, delivering a trenchant assessment of the economy at a meeting of party planners in Bai Daihe in July 1961. Only a few months earlier, attentive to the moods of the chairman, he had smoothed over widespread shortages, claiming that a socialist economy never developed in a straight line, as even the Soviet Union had gone through periods of decrease in grain output. But in the wake of Liu Shaoqi's attack, he no longer dodged the issue. In Shandong, Henan, and Gansu, he noted, tens of millions of farmers struggled to survive on a handful of grain a day, and the famine had little to do with natural calamities. People were starving because of the mistakes made by the party. He had 7 adjectives to describe the leap forward: too high, too big, too equal, meaning that all incentives had been erased, too dispersed, too chaotic, too fast, too inclined to transfer resources. A lengthy analysis followed, as well as concrete proposals aimed at lowering all production targets and getting the economy back on track. A close follower of Mao, he had an astute way of absolving him of all blame. "Chairman Mao's directives are entirely correct, but we, including the central organs, have made mistakes in executing them." Li received the chairman's endorsement. The following month he gave a similar report at a top-level party meeting in Lushan, again exempting the chairman from any responsibility. It was the turning point in the famine. Li was a soft-spoken, unassuming man, whose loyalty towards Mao could hardly be doubted and who, unlike Peng Dehuai, had found a way of presenting the facts without incurring his wrath. Mao, a paranoid leader who suspected betrayal behind the slightest disapproval, praised the report instead. A series of biting assessments followed Li Fuchun's speech. Li Yixing, a senior party secretary, reported that in 1958 more than 140,000 tons of farming tools had been thrown into the backyard furnaces in the model province of Henan. Wu Jingtian, vice minister of railways, explained how 1 in 5 locomotives was out of circulation because of engine damage. Peng De, vice minister of transportation, announced that fewer than 2 out of 3 vehicles under his command actually worked. Vice minister of metallurgy, Zhu Qi, noted that the steelworks of Anyang were forced to stop for weeks on end over the summer because of coal shortages.